And thank you for coming to this talk at such an early time of day. So my title, Asandu Sab, absorption, what is it, where do we find it, and what is it good for? I'm going to begin with a small amount of general background material for people who might appreciate the background. So, first of all, when we say absorption, we are referring to absorbing extensions. And so, the natural question number one is, what exactly is an extension? Well, so first of all, there is a purely algebraic correspondence between short exact sequences, which are called extensions, because the operation of choosing a C given B and A is the opposite of taking a quotient. So extensions are, in a sense, opposite of quotients. And then you see algebraically there is an equivalence between these short exact sequences and the so-called Busby maps. Busby maps are simply ordinary homomorphisms. Ordinary homomorphisms from an algebra A to the so-called corona of B. Now, you see, let me just explain what a corona is. In the commutative case, if B comes from a topological space, then the corona is what you get when you take the Stone-Check compactification and then compress the original space to a point. So, in the commutative case, for example, the corona of the integers Z will have cardinality higher than that of the real numbers. Therefore, you have a lot of maps from A into a corona. You have a lot of room, and therefore you have a lot of maps. Okay, now these maps can have various special properties. They can be trivial, which means that they lift to a homomorphism into the multipliers. They can be invertible, which means that they lift to a completely positive map. And usually they are essential, meaning injective. All right, so now extensions form a semigroup. This is pretty well known, so far this is all pretty well understood. Okay, so now if we have a copy of O2, the first Kunz algebra, in the multipliers, then we can define a binary operation on extensions. The operation is canonical up to unitary equivalence, is commutative and associative up to unitary equivalence. And this gives you a semigroup. So now you see the reason the operation is canonical is that if you have two different unitarily embedded copies of O2, then they are the same by a unitary equivalence in the multipliers. You can find a unitary outside the copy of O2 in the multipliers that conjugates one copy of O2 to the other. And therefore, up to multiplier unitary equivalence, I guess it's important that it's multiplier unitary equivalence, all the different additions are the same. So now, thinking of C-star algebraic K theory, we are going to ask, can we make the semigroup into a group? And the recipe that is used in K-theory is the so-called Grothendieck construction. The Gaussian deconstruction is the same one that goes from the natural numbers to the integers. It's purely algebraic. In the case of extensions, it is really not the best approach. So now, it was done better by Brown, Douglas, and Fermoy, using a theorem due to Voiculescu, and by Kasparov using his own generalization of Voiculescu's theorem. Kasparov simply took Voiculescu's theorem and rewrote the proof using Hilbert modules instead of Hilbert space. Well, and so now, the Grothendieck deconstruction basically amounts to saying that A is equal to B in the group if there is some extension C such that in the semigroup, A plus C is equal in the semigroup to B plus C. And in general, C will depend on A and B, which is not good. So summarizing this quickly, there are the various equivalence relations. Grothendieck, A is equivalent to B, as I just said, if there is some C which, when added on, gives you equivalence in the group. This is what you do in K-theory. And it works very well in K-theory. Now, what Kasparov did, he said that A is equal to B if A plus C is equal to B plus C in the semigroup for one special choice of C. Okay? And that's progress. Instead of checking all C, you just check one. It's called Kasparov's trivial absorbing extension. And then Kurzberg, for extensions of purely infinite simple algebras, the semigroup is already a group. And BDF based their work on noticing that by Voiculescu's theorem, extensions of K, the compact operators by A, are already a group. Now, in this kind of setting, you should probably think of K as being roughly the counterpart of S1. And we are talking about maps of S1 into some kind of non-commutative space. Now, this is something like a group of loops. Now, so the key idea here in all this has been that of an absorbing extension. So, as I said before, an extension is... I'm sorry, this one seems a little bit unclear. I don't know why. Okay, so the transparency says that an extension is trivial. It seems to be the wrong sort of plastic. An extension is trivial if it lifts to a homomorphism into the multipliers, motivated by Steinspring's theorem. That should be IE, not EI. Now, you don't know at the moment that the trivial extension is unique or trivial in the group. However, you define an extension to be absorbing if it's unitarily equivalent to its own sum with any trivial extension. In other words, an extension is absorbing if trivial extensions are algebraically trivial with respect to it. And so in the presence of absorption, triviality is equal to algebraic triviality. Well, and so naturally, this is going to simplify the equivalence relation on your group quite a bit. So, now, results about absorbing, yes? Yes. Well, something's wrong with this transparency. Which line? Here? Up this? Okay, definition. Okay, yes. Tau 1 is absorbing. If tau 1 plus tau 2 is unitarily equivalent to tau 1 for any trivial extension tau 2. And trivial is in quotation marks because it's defined in terms of lifting, not in terms of the group or semigroup, you see. And you would like triviality to mean triviality in the group. Okay, so to summarize then, when we are working with X, which has other names depending on who's giving the talk, when working with X, we have a choice. We can use ordinary extensions and a very coarse equivalence relation, which sounds fine. But then the problem is that it becomes extremely difficult to decide when two extensions are equivalent or not. If your equivalence relation is very coarse and involves, roughly speaking, unitary equivalence, compact perturbation in a Hilbert module sense, and addition of trivial extensions, then it is very difficult to decide whether one extension is equivalent or not to another. Or you can use absorbing extensions as your coset representatives, and then you can use a nice, pleasant equivalence relation. So now, let's see. Okay, so now, in chronological order then, since it is clearly important to decide which extensions are or are not absorbing, there's this interesting theorem here giving two if and only if conditions for an extension to be absorbing. So, first of all, there's this condition in terms of now C is an element of the extension algebra, and you have that CBC, the hereditary subalgebra generated in the canonical ideal, contains a stable full subalgebra. Or equivalently, you have this approximation property that H1 in the ideal can be approximated by C using one term. And those two things are equivalent to absorption. In number two here, C is an element of your extension algebra in the three in the short exact sequence picture, right? Any positive element, okay? Positive is important. So yes, of course, I imagine that there's about the same theorem for C, not necessarily positive, and then you would write CBC star. Well, and so then this has a instant corollary in terms of a factorization condition. If for any four positive element of the multipliers you have this factorization here, then every full extension is absorbing. And how do you get this? You simply apply part three, right? Because you see, if you have this, then you simply multiply the factorization equation on the right and the left by the square root of h. You simply multiply this equation on the left and on the right by the square root of h, and then you immediately get 3. So this implies that all full extensions are absorbing, but of course it's on the face of it a stronger condition. And you can move it into the corona too. So
Yeah, may I ask a question about the condition we've got B1 is the unit volume.
Yes.
And C1 is the unit volume.
Yes.
Okay. But then, I guess my question is similar to Ken's. What is R?
R is approximately in the unit bar. Over here, norm of R approximately equal to 1.
So the statement 3 should be that for every eight in the ball of B, you find an R.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah, it's just, yeah, exactly.
With the quantifiers put in.
Yes, yes. Oh, of course, yes, yes. It's, I should have been more specific. Of course, R depends on everything else.
Right, so what's the statement, the full statement?
Oh, okay, so the first statement is given H, it's enough to consider positive H, given H of norm 1, given C of norm 1 in the positive cone of the extension algebra, there exists an R of norm approximately 1, such that RC R star is approximately equal, by which I mean up to epsilon, to H, right? And this is from this paper back in 98.
And so, where does R
live? R is, well, yes, if you look at the proof, I mean, if you look at the proofs of these things, R is going to be in B. But that is when you go from two to three, you find out that R is in B. But I suppose for going from three to one, you don't need that R is in B. R in the multipliers would be fine. But of course, that's not very likely to happen, right? Because H is in B. It's natural and normal to expect that R is in B.
If you have R close to 1 in norm, then why not just say R is equal to 1 or 1?
Yes, actually.
Yes,
actually, that probably amounts to the same thing, yes. Yes, and actually, you see, I don't know of any way to establish 3 that's not going to give you R has norm exactly equal to 1. Well, let me hedge a little bit there. But when you prove 3, you almost always are going to get something about the norm of R. Yes, it's taken to have norm 1. Now, mind you, that's probably something you can do away with, right? Because if you look at one paper by Wardham and Kirchberg on purely infinite non-simple algebras, where there's a similar approximation condition, they eventually prove that having norm control on R is equivalent to the same statement without norm control on R. So in the definition of purely infinite and non-simple, you have no norm bound on R, and later on when studying the subject, you find out that, in fact, you can always assume a norm bound on R. But you see, I'm just being chronological here and saying what was proven here, you see, and here you had a norm bound on R. All right, and so now you can move this statement about the multipliers into the corona and vice versa. There's equivalence between this equation in the corona and in the multipliers. That has a one-line proof. If you have RC R star equal to 1 in the corona, then you simply lift, and you get RC R star equal to 1 plus B, and you cut down by an isometric. So you have a one-line proof, and Anyway, so I call this property corona factorization.
Yeah.
Well, and so now...
Another question.
Yes. Sure. Four positive multiplier elements.
What does that mean?
What does four mean? The ideal generated is a brief thing.
Okay.
Understand, that's a necessary condition for this equation, right? Because if you want RC R star equal to 1, then of course it's necessary that C be, well, in now ideal, right? Okay, so this is all from about 98. Now, anyway, so looking at a case related to ideals where you consider ideals in greater detail, then, well, if you assume a minor technical condition, assume that every hereditary kernel in A, in the quotient, contains a strictly positive element with connected spectrum. What's a hereditary kernel? Kernel of a state, a pure state. So if in every hereditary kernel of a pure state, you have a strictly positive element with connected spectrum, a very mild condition, then you have a similar sort of statement with a spectral condition on it. And so now the condition on C is extremely similar to the previous one, except that now you restrict to element C having a spectral condition. And then you get this theorem about a special kind of absorption. Now, since the topic of this talk is ordinary absorption, we specialized the case of ordinary absorption. And then, of course, you have a very similar sort of corollary to the one down here. So now you see, if for every four positive element in the multipliers with spectrum ZR1, you have an R quasi-inverting it, then every full extension is absorbing. And as before, it has an equivalent corona formulation. If you have it in the corona, you cut down by the seismometry and put it in the multipliers. All right, so now, what extensions are absorbing? Well, without trying to be comprehensive, then you have Boyko-Lescu's result. Extensions of K are Pimsner-Popa-Boyko-Lescu. If you tensor K by C of X, then it's absorbing. However, finite dimension of X is necessary. There are nice counterexamples if X is not finite dimensional. Then Kurzberg, purely infinite. Extensions of purely infinite are absorbing. And then extensions of, this is by myself and my postdoc, and then extensions of certain type 1 algebras are absorbing. There's a minor condition on decomposition rank, and we have a counterexample showing that the decomposition rank condition is necessary. Okay, now applications. Well, all right, so first of all, you have what's more or less the original application. And so now you suppose that B is in one of these absorbing algebra classes. Absorbing algebras are those having the property that every full extension of them is absorbing. And then if B is an absorbing algebra, then, well, approximate unitary equivalence classes in the multipliers are given by a spectral condition. So if you have that spectrum of an element, so this is really classical operator theory, okay? Very classical. So if the spectrum of T1 is equal to the spectrum of T2, and the essential spectrum of T1 is equal to the essential spectrum of T2, essential meaning after you take the quotient by the canonical ideal, then the two operators are unitarily equivalent. Modulo a small element B. You have norm control on B. The norm of B is arbitrarily small. So now, this theorem here actually goes back to about 1934, published in German in France, so not very many people read it, but you see the original formulation had B equal K. And so, of course, here we are saying that it's true for any absorbing algebra. For example, B can be O2. Okay, well, so now, one thing which, of course, many people have commented on is the similarity between Kronecker algebras and von Neumann algebras. Now, of course, I'm not going to say Kronecker algebras are von Neumann algebras. They certainly are not, no matter what representation you pick. But nevertheless, a lot of theorems for von Neumann algebras have a Kronecker algebra counterpart almost always with a separability condition, okay? So the intuition here is a theorem for a von Neumann algebra has some kind of chance in a Kronecker algebra if you can state it with a suitable separability condition on it. So, for example, in a von Neumann algebra, you have exact polar decomposition. Given an X, there is an partial isometry B such that X is equal to B, absolute value of X, and B is unique under very mild conditions. Now, in the Kronecker, you do have factorization, but the B is not unique, and it's not an isometry. B is just a contraction. Well, and so in a von Neumann algebra, you have a double annihilator property. And in the Kronecker, you have a double annihilator property for a smaller class of subalgebra. So here you need a sigma unital condition. There you don't. And of course, you have the double commutant theorem, which has no counterpart for the Kronecker. Or does it? Well, so Voikulescu showed a rather surprising, at least to me, theorem, which is that a separable unital subalgebra of the classical Kalkin algebra is equal to its own double relative commutant. Proven by Voikulescu, improved and publicized by Arveson. And it gave birth to a small industry involving lattices. Okay, separable unital subalgebras of the classical Kalkin algebra are equal to their own double relative commutant. Okay, so so just a minute here. Okay. Yep. So anyway, a separable unit or subalgebra, as I said, of the classic Kalkin algebra is equal to its own double relative commutant. And if you work harder, you can prove that in the corona of an absorbing algebra, the double relative commutant of a hereditary non-unit or sigma unit or subalgebra is equal to, has double relative commutant equal to its own unitization. So you have H inside the corona of an absorbing algebra. It's sigma unit or non-unit or you take its double relative commutant and you get the unitization of the original algebra. Okay, well, now, okay, anyway, so now, just a second, my slides have gotten out of order. Ah, yes, here. Okay, anyway, so here's a summary of various theorems on this general topic. So, Weil and von Neumann, 1930, they showed that unitary equivalence classes in the Kalkin algebra had a certain special rather nice behavior. Basically, they showed that there was a spectral characterization of equivalence classes in the corona, sorry, in the corona of K, the classical Kalkin algebra. And basically, the obvious spectral conditions were both necessary and sufficient. Well, and then Voikulescu showed that in the same sort of situation, all trivial extensions disappear. And now, of course, we know that the theorem by Voikulescu implies the one by Weil and von Neumann. Well, and then Kasparov came up with a Hilbert module proof of Kasparov's theorem. Everything was the same, except he had to work extremely hard to make certain theorems which are obvious for B of H go through. And so then he showed that there's a universal trivial extension. And this has been improved by Thompson. You see, here you have a condition on let me think for a second. Yes, all right. So there is a separability condition which has been weakened a little. Sorry. Yep. The separability condition has been weakened to sigma unit or by Klaus Thompson. And I can't remember if he weakened nuclearity or not. But anyway, so this has been improved a bit by Klaus Thompson. Now, Kurzberg, purely infinite simple, and then this phenomenon of characterization. I should, however, point out that in all cases, almost, separability seems to be reasonably important. And so the result by Klaus Thompson is quite interesting. So that's all. Thank you. Questions?
What is the in the summary?
Yep.
I don't see any mention of coronas, for instance.
Who?
Well, I mean, what is this a summary of? What is this a summary of the summary of?
Oh, okay. So this is not totally up to date, right? But this is just a summary of results about various classes of extension being absorbing, right? The early approach you see was to do it by algebra class, right? So what you did was you showed absorption for a certain class of algebra than another class of algebra and so on, right? The notion of trying to characterize absorption in general probably never occurred to anyone for a while. So, okay.
What would happen if you tried to summarize something involving what would you say was the next question after the next sort of thing to consider after this?
Okay. Well, if I had gone on a little bit, I would probably talk some more about applications of absorption, and actually, if I had more time, I'd probably talk about applications and perhaps also some alternative viewpoints about what exactly is absorption, because really it's a quite geometrical property. And when you phrase it in this context of extensions, that is not very clear, right? But it's actually a condition with geometrical significance.
Do you need that to do these calculations with X, or you just, this is just something you notice you can prove if you have one of these algebras in your class where the
you are asking, does absorption get used anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, what about the double commutant? Do you use that in calculating X?
No, it's more the other way around. Okay, so actually, that's an interesting comment. So, the viewpoint here was to use use the absorption theorems as a tool to establish this relative double commutant theorem, right? But actually, you know, I hadn't really thought about the question of how to use that to calculate X. And I would imagine that there might be some things you could say about, say, KK theory, maybe of the commutant, the single commutant, single relative commutant, that sort of thing. So there might indeed be something one might say about, given a hereditary subalgebra, in that kind of situation, look at its single relative commutant and look at its KK theory. But
Bill Paschke had a paper maybe 20 years ago, where he connected K0 and K1 using this
it's true that there are various vanishing theorems for K theory of commutants. If you have some sort of relative commutant in the corona, I think there are probably more recent theorems saying that, for example, K0 will vanish. Okay, so there are things you can say.